From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. The U.S. Justice Department recently hosted a full-day forum targeting free speech on college campuses. Among the participants, the North Carolina man who leads the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. You'll hear what he had to say. A retiring state lawmaker wants to attract attention to the topic of Lyme disease. You'll learn why he recently led a legislative discussion of the tick-related illness. Plus, we delve into issues related to North Carolina's recovery from Hurricane Florence. You'll hear one lawmaker's take on the storm. We'll also highlight educational challenges for the students and teachers who missed weeks of classes. Speaking of that major hurricane, it's also the topic at hand as Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The impact of Hurricane Florence on eastern and southeastern North Carolina is likely to be felt for many years. In addition to more than three dozen deaths, countless homes and businesses have been destroyed or damaged. Crops have been flooded. Schools have been closed. Lives have been upended. Now, with all of this as the backdrop, state lawmakers met earlier this month to review and pass a Hurricane Florence relief package. Carolina Journal was there, and Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins me now. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
Some of the stories that were related by members of the legislature on both sides of the aisle were just so heartbreaking and compelling. One of them really stood out to me in the Carolina Journal story. That came from State Representative Brendan Jones of Columbus County. Part of what he said was this: the town of Fairbluff is off the map.
Yeah, that was one of the towns that was hit really hard by Matthew, and at the time, Lindsay Marcello, one of our associate editors, went to Fairbluff on one of the disaster relief tours, if you will, of the Matthew damage assessment, and when Matthew relief was starting to come in, and people there were just starting to get some of the aid and just rebuild, and then within a few weeks they were underwater again and the city was basically wiped out.
Just incredible. Give us a sense of other stories or just the mood of that whole session as Carolina Journal reporters were there.
It was very, very somber. There was a fair amount of basically personal anecdotes being related by the various members. There were people there, of course, from the area who were, just wanted to see what the General Assembly would do to help. And there was, with I think only maybe one a minor exception, only one instance of any sort of partisan disagreement on anything, and it had to do with the relocation of early voting sites. That was really about it. Other than that, everything was extremely harmonious, and there was a lot of empathy that was going on in chambers.
Ultimately, what did lawmakers decide to do?
They took several steps. I mean, the main thing that they were attempting to do was to make sure that money that needed to be appropriated from the General Assembly was available. And that was the biggest issue, because otherwise they could have waited until they came back at the end of November. They're scheduled to return after the election. But one of the problems is there are a number of areas of that part of the state that need immediate assistance, and that assistance was not appropriated earlier by the General Assembly. So what they did was they created something that's called a Disaster Recovery Fund for Florence. And it's going to be the conduit through which money directly coming from the General Assembly or coming from federal grants or other sorts of government sources will go. And that will give the governor some discretion through his agencies and with legislative oversight to hand out some of these payments. I mean, the most immediate thing that I found compelling about it was the fact that many of these school districts were closed for weeks. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, at least one of them wasn't open as of early October still. And when the school district is closed, the personnel don't get paid. So that one of the things that the General Assembly wanted to do, and that's why they wanted to even come back before October 1st, before the end of the relevant pay period, was to release money so that teachers and other school staff could get paid throughout this period, because through no fault of their own, they can't go to work. And so that was the big thing, I think.
And in fact, Rick, a little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking with Dr. Terry Stoops of the John Locke Foundation a little bit more in depth about the impact on schools and kids and parents and teachers.
And that was the really immediate one, was the school funding and also waiving the length of the school year for some of these school districts. But also what was involved too was changing some of the voter deadlines with the election forthcoming. And now in early November, at the time of that we're recording this, about 4 weeks from when we're recording this, and the fact that early voting is going to start in mid-October. The first thing they did was, in that regard, was move the voter registration deadline from the 12th of October to the 15th, giving people a few more days to register. And, of course, people can do lots of things to register to vote. There are many ways to do it. And if they go to the State Board of Elections website, they can find that out. The next thing was early voting sites that may have been damaged by the storm, or whose access points may have been damaged by the storm. And this was yet another thing that they talked about at the session, was that you may have early voting locations where people are not able to get to a building that's in perfectly good shape. And so what basically happened at this point was the General Assembly changed the ruling and said that these sites, which have already been established, can be moved to other acceptable locations by a unanimous vote of the local board of education and local board of elections, excuse me. And that's where the partisan dispute came up, because there was a proposal to make that only majority vote and not a unanimous vote. And that was actually did not go past through the General Assembly, did not amend the bill, because David Lewis, who is head of the elections committee for the House, said, look, this is the procedure for every other situation involving early voting. And if you can't get a unanimous vote, then you can go to the State Board of Elections, and I'm sure they'll expedite anything that's necessary.
Let's talk a little bit more about the money. First of all, how much have they set aside to go into this special Florence Recovery Fund? And we're talking about state money here. Right. And where's it coming from?
$56.5 million in total, $6.5 million of that for education and $50 for other purposes. Much of it coming from the State Rainy Day Fund. And there will be more. There's no question about that, because the lawmakers are coming back in mid-October to have yet another special session once they've gotten past these sort of emergency provisions. And there will probably be hundreds of millions of dollars more going through this fund over the course of the next months or years. But this was the initial, they called it a down payment. That's exactly what it was. This was the initial payment.
So there would be federal funds coming into this special bucket of money, so to speak, and more state funds. And this has really put an interesting focus on the state's rainy day fund. And that has not been something that some people had warmly embraced over the past few years. There have been some who've said that state lawmakers were putting too much money into the rainy day fund. It's now sitting at about $2 billion or so. But this is exactly the type of situation it's meant for.
That's right. Yes. Governor Roy Cooper, when he was running for election in 2016, said that the state put away too much money for rainy day fund. They should have spent that money on immediate needs. Now that may be coming back to haunt him a little bit, because what we're finding out is that with the two disasters coming back to back, as the governor described it, two 500-year storms coming within 2 years of one another, the need for that money is very extensive. And as we found from earlier situations, we had disasters where the state legislature had to come back. The General Assembly had to pass a tax increase to cover funds because there was no reserve money available. And now with that $2 billion there, that makes a huge difference, and it allows the state to continue operating without having to go in and look at cutting other programs or raising taxes.
Now, you mentioned that they said this is just a down payment, so people should expect that more money would be moved from the rainy day fund into this Florence account?
Probably so, once they assess the actual needs for money. And there's going to be a lot of federal money coming in as well.
Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. You can read all of the reporting at carolinajournal.com. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents, their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats, Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The U.S. Justice Department recently tackled the issue of free speech on college campuses. Among the participants of Justice's day-long forum on the topic, Robert Shibley of North Carolina. He's executive director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. FIRE reviews written policies at more than 450 universities across the country.
According to our most recent report, 90.9% of them have at least one written policy that either directly infringes on the free speech rights of students or is written broadly enough to allow campus administrators to do so. About 33% to 40%, depending on how you look at it, have policies that prevent speech in such a way that it's what we would consider to be very obviously and tragically unconstitutional. And so we've over the years documented hundreds of examples of censorship of students on campus.
Shipley points to a disturbing trend.
We've been seeing lately, particularly in the academic quarter, this criticism that these actually aren't that big a deal. That, you know, while there are many instances of censorship on campus, when you compare it to the number of students on campus, to the number of campuses, it's actually not that severe. FIRE wanted to get hard data on whether or not this is happening. And so along with YouGov, we took a survey of 1,250 undergraduates that was administered by YouGov and funded by the John Templeton Foundation. And here's what we found. On a positive note, 87% of students, they answered yes to the statement, or they said they agreed with the statement, "In my college classes, I feel comfortable sharing my ideas and opinions." And they didn't vary much among across lines of race or gender. But when it came to ideology, we started to see a difference that very liberal students are 14 points more likely to feel comfortable sharing those opinions than their very conservative peers. And unfortunately, that high number, the general high number, though, there is even less of a reason to rejoice when you consider that more than half of the students surveyed, 54%, said they had stopped themselves from sharing an idea or opinion in a class at some point during college.
The survey didn't end there.
Why'd the students hold back? 53% of them who did indicated they were worried about being incorrect or mistaken. Another 20% shared concern that they would be given lower grades by their professors. Disturbingly, in considering culture, 48% said they were afraid that they would be judged by their peers. And that starts to look like an awful lot of incidents in which students think they have a good point to make, but don't make it for fear of peer pressure. Probably most alarming because of its sheer avoidability, though, is the 16% of students there who have self-censored inside the classroom, at least in part because they feared professors or fellow students would report them to campus employees. Combined with self-censorship due to peer pressure, it turns out that a substantial number of students have been holding back their views, even in class, for fear of facing some sort of retribution.
That's Robert Shibley of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He's speaking at a recent U.S. Justice Department forum on free speech on college campuses.
Thus far, we've talked about student attitudes regarding their own speech, but the picture actually looks different and unfortunately worse when we look at student attitudes towards others' speech. More than half of students, 58%, agreed with the statement that, quote, "it is important to be part of a campus community where I'm not exposed to intolerant and offensive ideas." There is an ideological difference here, with 63% of very liberal students and 45% of very conservative students feeling this way. But in terms of percentages, it's not as wide a gap as today's culture warriors might have guessed. Again, though, that top line number conceals some very real differences in what sort of speech counts as comfortable. For instance, while there's no legal definition of hate speech in our nation, and most of what people call hate speech is protected by the First Amendment, only 24% of liberal students believe that so-called hate speech should be protected compared to very conservative students. Yet when it comes to another constitutionally protected form of speech, campus protest, 64% of very conservative students agree that they, quote, should not have to walk past student protests on campus, while only 17% of liberal students agree. This poses a severe problem for those who believe that if campuses can just get speech regulations just right, they can get rid of the bad speech while still allowing the good. The fact is, while students often agree that there is good and bad speech, their definitions of good and bad often conflict.
Shipley also discussed outside speakers.
Given how much controversy we've seen in recent years around guest speakers visiting campuses, from conservative provocateurs to the first female head of the IMF, some colleges have suggested that bringing in outside speakers is simply no longer worth the trouble. For example, the University of South Carolina decreed that henceforth the university president would be the commencement speaker every year, thereby dodging the political bullet entirely. And after the riot at Berkeley last year during Milo Yiannopoulos' abortive attempt to speak on that campus, the college spent a shocking $600,000 to secure the campus for a visit from conservative speaker Ben Shapiro. Given that a university should be a place where students have access to all sorts of differing perspectives, are controversial speakers a luxury that campuses can afford to lose? Our survey indicated that the answer to this question is a resounding no. First of all, it would be enormously unpopular. 92% of students felt that having the opportunity to hear diverse guest speakers is important. And I think the survey made the reason for that clear. Guest speakers often serve to challenge students' deeply held beliefs or introduce students to new ways of thinking about the world, and they are amazingly successful in doing so. 64% of students admit that they changed at least one of my attitudes, perspectives, or opinions after hearing a guest speaker. This high number suggests not only that guest speakers bring valuable perspectives, but that students probably have not been sufficiently exposed to these perspectives through the campus culture alone, if so many have changed their minds on that issue after a single speech. It's also reason to be deeply concerned that despite their value, more than half of students, 56%, agree that there are instances wherein a college should disinvite a speaker, though again, there is widespread disagreement among who should be disinvited. And this short-sighted mode of thinking among students is contrary to the principles of liberal education. It deprives students of an opportunity not just to have their minds changed, but also of the chance to have their arguments strengthened by exposure to new ideas.
Shibley used an example to highlight the power and importance of persuasion.
There's a man we had speak at a conference for FIRE last year. His name is Daryl Davis, and he is a African-American musician. And his, I guess maybe you'd call it a hobby, is befriending members of the Ku Klux Klan. He goes to Klan rallies. He befriends members, and he tries to relate with them as a person. And so far, he has convinced dozens of them to leave the Klan. In fact, they give him his robe. He has a whole collection of KKK robes from people who are quitting. The reason I bring this person up and the reason we brought him to FIRE is because the key to trying to deal with this bad speech, and I think there's because campuses are a more diverse place and they are a place that there's much more ferment right now than maybe there was in past years, although certainly not from the 1960s. Is because we've given up, it seems, on persuading instead of coercing. There seems to be this sort of intellectual virus that's gotten in, this idea that if nobody ever hears something bad, if they don't hear that somebody doesn't like black people, if they don't hear anti-Semitism, that it wouldn't occur to them normally. And what I would suggest is that, I don't know whether or not that's true or not, but I do know that persuading somebody to change their mind is going to be a lot more effective than trying to make make sure that they're never exposed to that topic. And so I think to the extent that universities and other cultural institutions are currently making this effort to make it so that we're not persuading you, we're not letting other people persuade, but we're going to actually, you know, ban your speech if you step over the line, that's been a huge mistake.
That's North Carolina's Robert Shibley, Executive Director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He spoke at a recent U.S. Justice Department forum highlighting free speech issues on college campuses. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents. Their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers are already taking steps to address Hurricane Florence's impact on North Carolina. During a special session just weeks after the storm, the General Assembly tackled new legislation. It dealt with the hurricane's impact on schools, elections, even mosquitoes. Republican Senator Michael Lee of coastal New Hanover County tried to place the special session in perspective for his inland colleagues.
Those of us in my district, Representative Eiler's district, Senator Rabin and others, you know, we didn't get to see the storm like y'all saw the storm. We had no idea what was going on because we didn't have access to power. We didn't have access to television. The Internet really wasn't working at all on our phones because that was the only conduit to the outside world. It was odd in that you feel very kind of disconnected from the rest of the world. You have, to the extent there is a gas station that has gas, there are police officers there, there's a line that takes 2 hours to get through, and then you may be the person next to the last person that got gas, which is why the police officers were there. You may have tried to go to the grocery store. after a few days of the storm, only to find out that there was a line that wrapped around the building and there were very few groceries there. So I think that some of us in this room have been through hurricanes. This was not a normal hurricane. You know, I've had some people say, wow, you were lucky it was only a Category 1. You know, hurricanes usually last a day. They don't go 2 miles an hour. They don't last for three straight days. It's like we had three hurricanes every day for 3 days. So I know that there are going to be a lot of questions about why aren't we doing this and why aren't we doing that. But there's an incredible amount of uncertainty in a lot of our lives. Those of us who are lucky like me, who I will never complain about the damage that I've had and the disruption to my life, because there are so many others that have had so much more. There is so much uncertainty for everyone. The reason for coming before you today with a scaled-down bill is to provide some semblance of certainty for families, children, teachers, those who are working in the school system. Just one small piece of it, because there's so much out there that is not certain. And I know we're going to be working on hurricane relief for months, not weeks, probably long into the long session with some things that we're going to have to accomplish.
That's State Senator Michael Lee, Republican from coastal New Hanover County. He's discussing the General Assembly's initial efforts to address hurricane relief. Lee and his colleagues expect much more work. They'll be addressing Hurricane Florence's impact on the state for weeks and months to come. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina state lawmakers are taking a closer look at Lyme disease. The State House's Health Committee heard recently from Triad resident Naya Davenport.
2 years ago, this would not have been possible because of Lyme disease. For me to get here, to get out of the bed, the amount of pain and energy that it would have required was something I didn't have. The amount of focus, the ability to find the building, the ability to speak in a complete sentence without stuttering, the ability to stand these lights or even the sound of my own voice, to stand upright, to be able to turn my head. Those were all things that were out of my reach for a long period of time.
Davenport explained how her Lyme disease story started.
15 years ago, playing out in nature, didn't think anything was wrong. Sometime within a couple of weeks, I started developing some strange symptoms, fevers, achiness, and at one point was not able to move the joints in my hands. Being kind of a hard, charging, driven type A personality who also at the time had three young children at home, I wasn't allowed sick days, so I tried to muscle through it until my husband dragged me kicking and screaming to the emergency room. They figured out there was nothing wrong. It must have been a virus. Go home, sleep it off. So that's what I tried to do. And over the course of about 2 weeks, the symptoms did subside. But what I've discovered in the last decade is that is not a good thing. What happened was that I had been bitten by a tick and was not aware of it. And Lyme disease, along with some other co-infections, had gotten into my body and it had gone dormant.
In 2012, a series of life stressors brought the Lyme disease back into Davenport's life. But no one knew what was causing a range of debilitating health problems.
I had very caring doctors, and so they wanted to figure out what was going on. And each of them looked within what their area of expertise was, and at some point decided that the medicines weren't working, and we needed to figure out what was going on. By the time they all came to that conclusion, I had already started dying. I couldn't remember my name. I couldn't find my way out of my driveway. I had aches. I had pains. They were bearable, but they were disruptive to daily life. There were times where my children would walk in the room, and there was a blank in my mind because I didn't know who this person was, nor did I realize why I was in this room. Migraine headaches. I couldn't stand lights. Traveling was almost impossible. So finally, I went to one of my doctors and I said, I just want to be me. I can deal with the physical symptoms. I can't deal with the fact that I can't have a conversation with a client or with a child or with my husband. I can't remember things. And so they took me off of all my medicines. And when they did, the symptoms hit me full force. Literally could not speak. Could not think, had no emotions except one, rage.
Eventually, Davenport learned she had Lyme disease.
I knew nothing about Lyme disease. None of my local doctors were looking for Lyme disease. I had barely heard of Lyme disease, but I quickly became acquainted with it in a way that I never wanted to, and hope that none of you will ever have to.
Republican State Representative Burt Jones solicited the testimony from Nia Davenport. Jones explained to colleagues his own experience with Lyme disease.
I have, unfortunately, over the past 3 or 4 years, had the firsthand opportunity to learn a lot about this disease and, quite frankly, have met a lot of patients in this state that have Lyme's disease, and just see some of the common problems that they are facing and some of the common concerns that they have, frustrations that they have.
Jones's story hit particularly close to home.
About 4 years ago, my son, who was at the time about halfway through college, began experiencing some symptoms. And like most college students, the first place he went was his college infirmary, who thought that he had a virus and started treating him for that. And then he didn't get better and started having more problems with fatigue and pains and things like that. The bottom line is that over the next 12 months or so, we visited all kinds of specialists throughout North Carolina and Virginia particularly, and we never got a diagnosis until finally we went to a place where he was treated, diagnosed, tested, diagnosed, and then treated for Lyme's disease. So along the way, once we kind of got that diagnosis, continued to see some other doctors. We heard some very disturbing comments, if you will say, to the least. I've had a doctor tell me that Lyme disease doesn't exist in North Carolina. I wasn't aware of that. When I got my major in biology and went through dental school, I'd never learned that microbes had that kind of respect for state lines, but apparently some people feel like that they do. I've heard a doctor say that they would bet their medical license that we didn't have Lyme's disease. It really doesn't exist around here. I had another family member that was being tested for Lyme disease that had a doctor basically laugh in their face because they'd been bitten by a tick and were starting to have some symptoms, wanted to see if they could get some, medication, some doxycycline, if you will, to treat it. He laughed at them, told them that, that didn't exist around here, but just to make them feel good, he prescribed them one tablet. So when they got to the pharmacist just laughed and said, that's a joke.
Jones says this story is far too common in North Carolina.
There are a lot of problems out there that patients are having to deal with in getting a proper diagnosis, in getting treatment. I would just tell you that over the past 3 years, Our family has invested tens of thousands of dollars that has not been helped by insurance for the most part, because, as the doctor said, chronic Lyme disease is not recognized as an illness. And so there are a lot of patients, I will guarantee you, in every one of your districts that are dealing with this. And they are very frustrated. They're very concerned. They're having a hard time just getting a diagnosis, receiving treatment.
Jones is retiring from the General Assembly at the end of the year. He doesn't want to leave before raising awareness about Lyme disease.
A purpose of this is that we are increasing awareness, that that we are offering some hope for patients out there who are experiencing all kinds of symptoms. My son basically had to leave college for a year because of it. And again, by the grace of God, he was able to return. But I have seen firsthand several citizens of ours who are dealing with this. And I hope that there's something that we can do to help them.
That's Republican State Representative Burt Jones. Before he retires from the General Assembly, he's trying to raise awareness about the dangers of Lyme disease in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents, their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Earlier in the program, we told you about the $56.5 million relief package that was passed by the General Assembly to help with devastation from Hurricane Florence. Now, a portion of that money is targeted specifically to the immediate needs of North Carolina schools and kids and teachers. Superintendent of Public Instruction Mark Johnson has been saying that at one point, more than 1.2 million kids actually missed school days because of Florence. And as of early October, that more than 100,000 kids were still out of school. So what does that mean for the families, these kids, the teachers, and the facilities themselves? Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies. Terry, welcome back. I'm always glad to talk with you, but this is a topic that's really, really troubling for North Carolina. Give us a sense of what you're hearing from your contacts in the education community in the parts of the state that are so affected.
Well, a lot of them are just trying to get the basic necessities to go from day to day, the food, the water that they need, and just to make sure that life returns to some semblance of normalcy. Now, teachers, some teachers are going back to their classrooms. They're finding issues with their classrooms. And, of course, they have to get the all clear before anyone returns back to school. That means making sure that there's no mold or issues inside the classroom that can affect the health of the students and the teachers. Teachers, of course, from what I'm hearing, are very concerned about the missed school days. We have to remember that part of our evaluation of schools is based on test scores, and I think teachers are worried about now compressing a lot of the content that they were able to spread out through a regular length school year into the remaining school year, and that is going to be a challenge. So you have the facilities side, and then you have the instructional side, and both are going to be extreme challenges for teachers in these affected areas.
Let's talk a little bit more about what lawmakers did as part of the relief package. We know that the total package was $56.5 million, and they have said this is just the first installment, and that doesn't account for federal funds that will be coming in as well. A portion of that specifically to education, they said that they needed some money immediately. What was that for?
These were mainly for hourly employees. The salaried employees, that funding has already been set aside. So teachers will more likely than not receive their salary for the days that they missed. But the hourly employees, that's a different story. And so as a way to ensure that they received money for days that they missed, the General Assembly decided to set aside some money for them. We're thinking of cafeteria workers and of course, janitors and other hourly employees that, of course, were not able to work during or haven't been able to work during the cleanup here after the storm. And that's just really going to be the tip of the iceberg because there's food spoilage. That's going to be an issue. So they're going to have to find money, perhaps federal money, that will pay for the food that was damaged during the storm. There were cafeteria equipment that was damaged. So the equipment that's used to heat up the lunches and to keep them warm will need to be replaced. And, of course, these kitchens incurred some damage themselves. So before you actually even prepare food in the kitchen, you need to make sure that it doesn't have mold or other mildew issues that could affect and sicken the school. So there's a lot of issues there that with not only the hourly employees but where they work that will need to be resolved.
That facilities question, I think, is a huge one because we have heard descriptions of some people who've toured the areas that there are some schools that had like 3 feet of water in them. So there are the mold issues you're talking about, but just getting a building ready and making sure that it's safe and healthy for people to come back into is the number one issue before you can even deal with issues of, all right, what do we do for these kids who have now been out of school for a long time?
That's right, and it may require some creativity on the part of the school board to find facilities and spaces, perhaps unconventional ones, that students can have class in. And this might be renting spaces from churches or other areas of the community that may not be used to hosting a public school. They may have to get creative if their buildings are not able to be cleared by the appropriate authorities in a timely manner.
Let's talk more then about what happens when kids actually get back into a classroom, whether it's in the building that they are used to attending or whether it's in a church or wherever. What do you do then, Terry, when kids have been out for so long? Are there laws that require that they spend a certain number of days in class? And what do you do with that calendar?
The calendar law in North Carolina says that students need to be in class 185 days or 1,025 hours of instruction in the basic subjects. The calendar law stipulates when the school year starts and ends. So lawmakers had to give some exceptions to the calendar law as it stands. And this is up to 20 days they're able to write off and not be subject to the calendar law, so they can take 20 days off the calendar if they need to. I don't think a lot of schools are going to do that. I think what they're going to do is lengthen the school day and perhaps even lengthen classes so that teachers are able to get the content that students need to know in their class. Now, I won't say fortunately, but fortunately, this was at the beginning of the school year. So teachers are able to assess what they need to do for the rest of the school year. Had this occurred in, say, March or April, it would have been very difficult for teachers to be able to envision what they needed to have students learn before they receive their testing, state testing in June. So they actually have some time to be able to map it out, and that's what they will do. And I think part of it will be extending the school day, perhaps excusing some days. But I don't think that given how much in content that teachers have to teach kids, that there's going to be much of an opportunity for them to just skip over topics. That's not going to happen.
Terry, you're a former teacher yourself. What about the psychological impact on kids and on teachers coming back into that situation? Does that have to be something that's factored into the curriculum or how these kids are treated?
It absolutely has to. And I was a teacher when 9/11 happened, so I actually had to deal with some of the psychological issues of what happened after that. So I understand that students, when they come back, are going to be distracted. They're going to want to talk about what happened. They're going to want to talk to their classmates about everything that happened and what they have experienced, what they need. And so, you know, you have to make some – give them some room to be able to do that, to talk about it. But you also have to get them back on task. And that's the difficult part for a lot of teachers, not only getting them back on task, but perhaps covering some of the content that they covered before the storm. Because, of course, the curriculum is meant to build on each other. And if students have been out for an extended period, then the content that they learned at the beginning of the school year may be something that a lot of them have forgotten, or they're not able to tie it to the content that they'll receive once they return. So that is the challenge that I think a lot of teachers are going to face, is they're going to have to review what was covered during at the beginning of the school year, give students the room to be able to talk about what happened and what happened to their families, and then get them back on task to make sure that all the content that they need to cover begins to be covered upon their return.
It's an incredible challenge for everyone involved here. We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Director of Education Studies, also the Vice President for Research for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Terry. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.